Norwood during the Whitsun holiday. It was a decisive battle, because it was in some ways the 12th century equivalent of what later came to be called a total war. The 11 kings were ready to fight their sovereign in the Norman way, in the fox-hunting way of Henry II and of his sons, for sport and acquisition, and without the real intention of doing each other a personal injury. They, the kings with the tank-like knights of their nobility, were prepared to take a sporting risk. It was the kind of risk which Jorrocks talked about. King Lot might have said with justice that the rebellion which he led against Arthur was the image of fox-hunting without its guilt, and only 25% of its danger. But the 11 kings needed a background for their exploits. Even if the knights had little wish to kill each other on the grand scale, there was no reason why they should not kill the serfs. It would have been a poor day's sport indeed, according to their estimation, without a bag to counter the end of it. So the war, as the rebel lords had wished to fight it, was a kind of double battle, or war within a war. On the outer circle, there were 60,000 kerns and gallowglasses marching with the 11, and these ill-armed levies of the old ones were inflamed against the 20,000 foot soldiers of Arthur's Sassenach army by the tragedy of the Gael. Between the armies, there was a serious racial enmity. But it was an enmity controlled from above, by nobles who were not sincerely anxious for each other's blood. The armies were packs of hounds, as it were, whose struggle with each other was to be commanded by masters of hounds, who took the matter as an exciting gamble. If the hounds had turned mutinous, for instance, Lot and his allies would have been ready to ride with Arthur's knights in quelling what they would have considered a real rebellion. The nobles of the inner circle on both sides were in a way traditionally more friendly with each other than with their own men. For them, the numbers were necessary for the sake of their bag and for scenic purposes. For them, a good war had to be full of arms, shoulders and heads flying about the field, and blows ringing by the water and the wood. But the arms, shoulders and heads would be those of villeins, and the blows which rang, without removing many limbs, would be exchanged by the iron nobility. Such, at any rate, was the idea of battle in Lot's command. When sufficient kerns had been decapitated, and sufficient rough handling had been dealt out to the English captains, Arthur would recognise the impossibility of further resistance. He would capitulate. Financial terms of peace would be agreed on, which would yield an excellent profit in ransoms, and all would be more or less as it had been before, except that the fiction of feudal overlordship would be abolished, which was a fiction in any case. Naturally, a war of this sort was likely to be hedged with etiquette, just as fox-hunting is hedged with it. It would begin at the advertised meet, weather permitting, and it would be conducted according to precedent. But Arthur had a different idea in his head. It did not seem to him to be sporting, after all, that 80,000 humble men should be lewd against each other while a fraction of their number, in carapaces like the skins of tanks, manoeuvred for the sake of ransom. He had begun to set a value on heads, shoulders and arms, their owner's value, even if the owner was a serf. Merlin had taught him to distrust the logic by which countrysides could be pillaged for forage, husbandmen ruined, soldiers slaughtered, so that he himself should pay a scatheless ransom, like the Coeur de Lion of the legends. The King of England had ordered that there were to be no ransoms in his sort of battle. His knights were to fight not against gallowglasses, but against the knights of the Gaelic Confederation. Let the gallowglasses fight among themselves, if they must. Indeed, since there was a real aggression for them to settle, apart from the question of ransoms, let them fight to the best of their ability. But as for his nobles, they were to attack the nobles of the rebels, as if they were gallowglasses and nothing more. They were to accept no composition, observe no ballet dancers' rules. They were to press the war home to its real lords, until they themselves were ready to refrain from warfare, being confronted with its reality. Afterwards, He knew for certain now it was to be the destiny of his life to deal with every way of twisting decency by threats of power. So we may well believe that the king's men were shriven on the night before they fought. Something of the young man's vision had penetrated to his captains and his soldiers. Something of the new ideal of the Round Table, which was to be born in pain. Something about doing a hateful and dangerous action for the sake of decency. For they knew that the fight was to be fought in blood and death without reward. They would get nothing but the unmarketable conscience of having done what they ought to do in spite of fear. Something which wicked people have often debased by calling it glory with too much sentiment, but which is glory all the same. This idea was in the hearts of the young men who knelt before the God-distributing bishops, knowing that the odds were 3-1 and that their own warm bodies might be cold at sunset. Arthur began with an atrocity and continued with other atrocities. The first one was that he did not wait for the fashionable hour. He ought to have marshalled his battle opposite Lot's as soon as their breakfast was over, and then, at about midday, when the lines were properly in order, he should have given the signal to begin. The signal having been given, he should have charged Lot's footmen with his knights, while Lot's knights charged his footmen, and there would have been a splendid slaughter. Instead, he attacked by night, in the darkness, with a war whoop, deplorable and ungentlemanly tactics. He fell on the insurgent camp with the blood pounding in the veins of his neck and Excalibur dancing in his hand. He had taken the odds of 3-1. In knights, he was wildly outmatched. A single king of the rebels, the king of the 100 knights, had with his own forces 2/3 of the total number to which the Round Table was ever to grow. And Arthur had not started the war. He was fighting in his own country, hundreds of miles within his own borders, against an aggression which he had not provoked. Down came the tents, up flared the torches, out flew the blades, and the yell of battle mingled with the lamentation of surprise. The noise, the slaughtering and slaughtered, demons black against the flames. What scenes there have been in Sherwood, where now the oak trees crowd into a shade. It was a masterful start, and it was rewarded by success. The 11 kings and their barons were in armour already. It took so long to arm a nobleman that he was often accomplished overnight. If they had not been, it might have been an almost bloodless victory. Instead, it was an initiative, and the initiative held. The chivalry of the old ones fought their way from the ruined encampment hand to hand. They managed to unite into an armoured regiment, which was still several times larger than anything in armour which the king could bring against them, but they were deprived of their accustomed screen of footmen. There had been no time to organise the gallowglasses, and such of these as did remain with the nobility were demoralised or leaderless. Arthur detached his own footmen, under Merlin, to deal with the infantry battle which was centred round the camp, and he himself pressed on with his cavalry against the kings themselves. He had them on the run, and saw that he must keep them on it. They were indignantly surprised by what they considered unchivalrous personal outrage, outrageous to be attacked with positive manslaughter, as if a baron could be killed like a Saxon kern. The king's second atrocity was that he neglected the kerns themselves. That part of the battle, the racial struggle, which had a certain reality, even if it was a wicked one, he left to the races themselves, to the infantry and to Merlin's direction at the struggling camp from which the cavalry was already sweeping away. There were 3 gales to every Gaul among the tents, but they were surprised and taken at a disadvantage. He wished them no particular harm, concentrating his indignation upon the leaders who had seduced their addled pates, but he knew that they would have to be allowed their fight. He hoped that it would be a victorious one, so far as his own troops were concerned. In the meantime, his business was with the leaders, and as the day dawned, the atrociousness of his conduct became apparent. for the 11 kings had assembled some apology for an infantry screen behind which to wait his charges. He ought to have charged this screen of terrified men, dealing them an enormous execution. Instead, he neglected them. He galloped through the infantry as if they were not his enemies at all, not even troubling to strike at them, pressing his charge against the armoured corps itself. The infantry, for their part, accepted the mercy only too thankfully. They behaved as if it was not an honour to be allowed to die for Lothian. The discipline, as the rebel generals said afterwards, was not Pictish. The charges began with the growing day. At a military tattoo, perhaps, or at some old piece of showground pageantry, you may have seen a cavalry charge. If so, you know that seen is not the word. It is heard, the thunder, earthshake, drumfire, of the bright and battering sandals. Yes, and even then it is only a cavalry charge you are thinking of, not a chivalry one. Imagine it now, with the horses twice as heavy as the soft-mouthed hunters of our own midnight pageants, with the men themselves twice heavier on account of arms and shield. Add the cymbal music of the clashing armour to the jingle of the harness. Turn the uniforms into mirrors, blazing with the sun, and the lances into spears of steel. Now the spears dip, and now they're coming. The earth quakes under feet. Behind, among the flying clods, there are hoof prints stricken in the ground. It is not the men that are to be feared, not their swords, nor even their spears, but the hooves of the horses. It is the impetus of that shattering phalanx of iron, spread across the battlefront, inescapable, pulverizing, louder than drums, beating the earth. The knights of the Confederation met the outrage as they could. They stood to it and fought back. But the novelty of their situation as objects of ferocity, in spite of their rank, and also as a large body being charged with arrogance by a body numbering less than a quarter of their own, and being charged again and again into the bargain, this had an effect on their morale. They gave ground before the charges, still orderly but giving, and were shepherded along a glade of Sherwood Forest, a wide glade like an estuary of grass, with trees on either side. During this phase of the battle, there was a display of bravery by various individuals. King Lot had personal success against Sir Meliot de la Roche and against Sir Clarience. He was unhorsed by Kay, and horsed again only to be wounded in the shoulder by Arthur himself, who was everywhere, youthful, triumphant, overexcited. As a general, Lot seems to have been a martinet and something of a coward, but he was a tactician in spite of his formality. He seems to have recognised by noon that he was faced by a new kind of warfare, which required a new defence. The demons of Arthur's cavalry were not concerned with ransoms, it was now seen, and they were prepared to go on smashing their heads against the wall of his cavalry until it broke. He decided to wear them out. At a hurried council of war behind the line, it was arranged that he himself, with four other kings and half the defenders, should retire along the glade to prepare a position. The remaining six kings were sufficient to hold the English while Lot's men rested and reformed. Then, when the position was prepared, the six kings of the advance guard were to retire through it, leaving Lot in the front line while they reformed. The many split accordingly. Arthur accepted this moment of division as the opportunity for which he had been waiting. He sent an equerry to gallop for the trees. He had made a pact of mutual aid with two French kings, called Ban and Bor, and these two allies had come from France with about 10,000 men to lend him aid. The Frenchmen had been hidden in the forest on either side of the clearing as reserves. It had been in their direction that the king had tried to drive the enemy. The equerry galloped. There was a twinkle of armour among the leafy oaks, and Lot's mind jumped to the trap. He looked only to the one side of the glade, where Bor was issuing already upon his flank, being unaware at present that Ban was on the other wing. Lot's nerve began to collapse at this stage. He was wounded in the shoulder, faced by an enemy who seemed to accept the death of gentlemen as part of warfare, and now he was in an ambush. "Oh, defend us from death and horrible maims," he is reported to have said, "for I see well we be in great peril of death." He detached King Carados with a strong squadron to meet King Bor, only to find that a second equerry had sprung King Ban from the opposite side of him. He was still in numerical superiority, but his nerve was now gone for good. "Ha," he said to the Duke of Cambenet, "we must be discomfited." He is even supposed to have wept for pity and dole. Carados was personally unhorsed, and his squadron broken by King Bor. The advance guard of six kings was driven in by Arthur's charges. Lot, with King Morganore's division, faced about in order to hold King Ban upon his wing. The rebellion would have been ended on that day with one more hour of daylight. But the sun set, coming to the rescue of the old ones, and there was no moon for that quarter. Arthur called off the hunt, judged accurately that the insurgents were demoralized, and allowed his men to sleep in comfort on their arms, with few but careful sentries. The exhausted army of his enemies, who had diced the night before, now spent the hours of darkness, sleepless again, standing to arms or in their councils. Like all the Highland armies that have ever marched against Gramarye, they were distrustful of each other. They expected another night attack. They were dismayed by what they had suffered. They were divided on the subject of capitulation or resistance. It was the brink of daylight before King Lot could have his way. The remaining infantry, by his orders, were to be turned off like so many cattle, to stray and save their naked legs however they could. The knights were to band themselves into a single phalanx to resist the charges, and any man who ran away thereafter was to be shot at once for cowardice. In the morning, almost before they were formed, Arthur was on them. In conformity with his own tactics, he sent only a small troop of 40 spears to start the work. These men, a picked striking force of gallants, resumed the onslaughts of the previous afternoon. They came down at a hand gallop, smashed through the rank or broke it, reformed and came again. The dogged regiment withdrew before them, sullen, dispirited, the fight knocked out of it. At noon, the three kings of the Allies struck with their full force in a final blow. There was the moment of intermingling with a noise like thunder, the spectacle of broken lances sailing in the air while horses pawed that element before they went down backward. There was a yell that shook the forest. After it, on the trodden turf with its hoof marks and kicked sods and a debris of offensive weapons, there was an unnatural silence. There were people riding about aimlessly at a walk, but there were no longer any organized traces of the chivalry of the Gael. Merlin met the king as he rode back from Saw Haute, a magician rather tired and still unmounted. He was dressed in the infantry habergeon in which he had insisted on fighting. He brought the news that the clans on foot had offered their capitulation. Chapter 13. In the September moonlight several weeks later, King Pellinor was sitting on the cliff-top with his fiancée, staring out to sea. Soon they were setting off for England to be married. His arm was about her waist and his ear was pressed to the top of her head. They were unconscious of the world.
"But Dornar is such a funny name," the king was saying. "I can't think how you thought of it."
"But you thought of it, Pellinor."
"Did I?"
"Yes, Aglovale, Percival, Lamorack, and Dornar."
"They will be like cherubs," said the king fervently, "like cherubim. What are cherubim?"
Behind them the ancient castle loomed against the stars. There was a faint noise of shouting from the top of the round tower, where Grummore and Palomides were arguing with the questing beast. She was still in love with her counterfeit, and still kept the castle in a state of siege, which had only been broken for a few hours on the day of Lot's return with his defeated army. It had been a surprise for the English knights to learn that they had been at war with Orkney all the time, but it was too late to do anything about it, since the war was over. Now everybody was inside, the drawbridge was permanently up, and Glatisant lay in the moonlight at the foot of the tower, her head gleaming like silver. Pellinor had refused to have her killed. Merlin arrived one afternoon in the course of his northern walking tour, wearing a haversack and a pair of monstrous boots. He was sleek and snowy and shining, like an eel preparing for its nuptial journey to the Sargasso Sea, for the time of Nimue was at hand. But he was absent-minded, unable to remember the one thing which he ought to have told his pupil, and he listened to their difficulties with an impatient ear.
"Excuse me!"
they shouted from the top of the wall, as the magician stood outside.
"But it's about the questing beast! The Queen of Lothian and Orkney is in a frightful temper about her!"
"Are you sure it is about the beast?"
"Certainly, my dear fellow. You see, she has us besieged."
"We dressed up," bawled Sir Palomides miserably, "as a sort of beast ourselves, respected sir. And she saw us coming into the castle. There are signs of ardent affection. Now this creature will not go away because she believes her mate to be inside, and it is of a great unsafety to lower the drawbridge."
"You had better explain to her. Stand on the battlements and explain the mistake."
"Do you think she will understand?"
"After all," the magician said, "she is a magic beast. It seems possible."
But the explanation was a failure. She looked at them as if she thought they were lying.
"I say, Merlin, don't go yet."
"I have to go," he said absently. "I have to do something somewhere, but I can't remember what it is. Meanwhile, I shall have to carry on with my walking tour. I am to meet my master Blaise in Northumberland so that he can write down the chronicles of the battle. And then we are to have a little wild goose watching, and after that, well, I can't remember."
"But, Merlin, the beast would not believe."
"Never mind."
His voice was vague and troubled.
"Can't stop, sorry. Apologize to Queen Morgause for me, will you? And say I was asking after her health."
He began to revolve on his toes, preparatory to vanishing. Not much of his walking tour was done on foot.
"Merlin! Merlin, wait a bit!"
He reappeared for a moment, saying in a cross voice,
"Well, what is it?"
"The beast will not believe us. What are we to do?"
He frowned.
"Psychoanalyze her,"
he said eventually, beginning to spin.
"But, Merlin, wait! How are we to do this thing?"
"The usual method."
"But what is it?"
they cried in despair. He disappeared completely, his voice remaining in the air.
"Just find out what her dreams are and so on. Explain the facts of life.
But not too much of Freud."
After that, as a background to the felicity of King Pellinore, who refused to bother with trivial problems, Grummore and Palomides had to do their best.
"Well, you see,"
Sir Grummore was shouting,
"when a hen lays an egg—"
Sir Palomides interrupted with an explanation about pollen and stamens. Inside the castle, in the royal chamber of the Peel Tower, King Lot and his consort were laid in the double bed. The king was asleep, exhausted by the effort of writing his memoirs about the war. He had no particular reason for staying awake. Morgause was sleepless. Tomorrow she was going to Carlion for Pellinore's wedding. She was going, as she had explained to her husband, in a manner of a messenger, to plead for his pardon. She was taking the children with her. Lot was angry about the journey and wished to forbid it, but she knew how to deal with that. The Queen drew herself silently out of the bed and went to her coffer. She had been told about Arthur since the army returned, about his strength, charm, innocence, and generosity. His splendour had been obvious, even through the envy and suspicion of those he had conquered. Also, there had been talk about a girl called Leonore, the daughter of the Earl of Sanam, with whom the young man was supposed to be having an affair. The Queen opened the coffer in the darkness and stood near the moonlit patch from the window, holding a strip of something in her hands. It was like a tape. The strip was a less cruel piece of magic than the black cat had been, but more gruesome. It was called the spancel, after the rope with which domestic animals were hobbled, and there were several of them in the secret coffers of the old ones. They were a pisog rather than a great magic. Morgause had got it from the body of a soldier, which had been brought home by her husband for burial in the out isles. It was a tape of human skin, cut from the silhouette of the dead man. That is to say, the cut had been begun at the right shoulder, and the knife, going carefully in a double slit so as to make a tape, had gone down the outside of the right arm, round the outer edge of each finger, as if along the seams of a glove, and up on the inside of the arm to the armpit. Then it had gone down the side of the body, down the leg, and up it to the crutch, and so on, until it had completed the circuit of the corpse's outline, at the shoulder from which it had started. It made a long ribbon. The way to use a spancel was this. You had to find the man you loved while he was asleep. Then you had to throw it over his head without waking him and tie it in a bow. If he woke while you were doing this, he would be dead within the year. If he did not wake until the operation was over, he would be bound to fall in love with you. Queen Morgause stood in the moonlight, drawing the spancel through her fingers. The four children were awake too, but they were not in their bedroom. They had listened on the stairs during the royal dinner, so they knew that they were off to England with their mother. They were in the tiny Church of the Men, a chapel as ancient as Christianity in the islands, though it was scarcely 20 feet square. It was built of unmortared stones like the great wall of the keep, and the moonlight came through its single unglazed window to fall on the stone altar. The basin for holy water on which the moonlight fell was scooped out of the living stone, and it had a stone lid cut from a flake to match it. The Orkney children were kneeling in the home of their ancestors. They were praying that they might be true to their loving mother, that they might be worthy of the Cornwall feud which she had taught them, and that they might never forget the misty land of Lothian where their father reigned. Outside the window, the thin moon stood upright in a deep sky like the paring of a fingernail for magic, and against the sky the weather vane of the carrion crow, with arrow in mouth, pointed its arrow to the south. Chapter 14. Fortunately for Sir Palomides and Sir Grummore, the questing beast saw reason at the last moment, before the cavalcade set out. Otherwise they would have had to stay in Orkney and miss the marriage altogether. Even as it was, they had to stay up all night. She recovered quite suddenly. The drawback was that she transferred her affection to the successful analyst, to Palomides, as so often happens in psychoanalysis, and now she refused to take any further interest in her early master. King Pellinore, not without a few sighs for the good old days, was forced to resign his rights in her to the Saracen. This is why, although Malory clearly tells us that only a Pellinore could catch her, we always find her being pursued by Sir Palomides in the later parts of the Mort d'Arthur. In any case, it makes very little difference who could catch her, because nobody ever did. The long march southwards towards Caerleon, with litters swaying and the mounted escort jogging under flapping pennoncels, was exciting for everybody. The litters themselves were interesting. They consisted of ordinary carts with a kind of flagstaff at each end. Between the staffs, a hammock was slung, in which the jolts were hardly felt. The two knights rode behind the royal conveyances, delighted at being able to get out of the castle and see the marriage after all. St. Turdelbach followed with Mother Morlan, so that it would be a double wedding. The questing beast brought up the rear, keeping a tight eye on Palomides, for fear of being let down once again. All the saints came out of their beehives to see them off. All the Fomorians, Firbolg, Tuar de Danorn, old people and others waved to them without the least suspicion from cliffs, curraghs, mountains, bogs and shell mounds. All the red deer and unicorns lined the high tops to bid goodbye. The terns came with their forked tails from the estuary, squeaking away as if intent upon imitating an embarkation scene on the wireless. The white-bottomed wheat-ears and pipits flitted along beside them from whin to whin. The eagles, peregrines, ravens and choughs made circles over them in the air. The peat smoke followed them as if anxious to make one last curl in the tips of their nostrils. The Ogham stones and souterrains and promontory forts exhibited their prehistoric masonry in a blaze of sunlight. The sea trout and salmon put their gleaming heads out of the water. The glens, mountains and heather shoulders of the most beautiful country in the world joined the general chorus, and the soul of the Gaelic world said to the boys in the loudest of fairy voices, "Remember us!" If the march was exciting for the children, the metropolitan glories of Caerleon were enough to take their breath away. Here, round the king's castle, there were streets, not just one street, and castles of dependent barons, and monasteries, chapels, churches, cathedrals, markets, merchants' houses. There were hundreds of people in the streets, all dressed in blue or red or green or any bright colour, with shopping baskets over their arms, or driving hissing geese before them, or hurrying hither and thither in the livery of some great lord. There were bells ringing, clocks smiting in belfries, standards floating, until the whole air above them seemed to be alive. There were dogs and donkeys and palfreys in comparison, and priests and farm wagons whose wheels creaked like the day of judgment, and booths which sold gilt gingerbread, and shops where the finest bits of armour in the latest fashions were displayed. There were silk merchants and spice merchants and jewellers. The shops had painted trade signs hung over them, like the inn signs which we have today. There were servitors carousing outside wine shops, and old ladies haggling over eggs, and itinerant cads carrying cages of hawks for sale, and portly aldermen with gold chains, and brown ploughmen with hardly any clothes on except a few bits of leather, and leashes of greyhounds, and strange eastern men selling parrots, and pretty ladies mincing along in high dunces' caps with veils floating from the top of them, and perhaps a page in front of the lady carrying a prayer book if she was going to church. Caerleon was a walled town, so that this excitement was surrounded by a battlement which seemed to go on for ever and ever. The wall had towers every 200 yards, and four great gates as well. When you were approaching the town from across the plain, you could see the castle keeps and church spires springing out of the wall in a clump, like flowers growing in a pot. King Arthur was delighted to see his old friends again, and to hear of Pellinore's engagement. He was the first knight he had taken a fancy to when he was a small boy in the Forest Sauvage, and he decided to give the dear fellow a marriage of unexampled splendour. The Cathedral of Carlion was booked for it, and no trouble was spared that a good time should be had by all. The pontifical nuptial high mass was celebrated by such a galaxy of cardinals and bishops and nuncios that there seemed to be no part of the immense church which was not teeming with violet and scarlet and incense and little boys ringing silver bells. Sometimes a boy would rush at a bishop and ring a bell at him. Sometimes a nuncio would pounce on a cardinal and sense him all over. It was like a battle of flowers. Thousands of candles blazed before the gorgeous altars. In every direction, the blunt, accustomed, holy fingers were spreading little tablecloths, or holding up books, or blessing each other thoroughly, or soaking each other with holy water, or reverently displaying God to the people. The music was heavenly, both Gregorian and Ambrosian, and the church was packed. There were monks and friars and abbots of every description, standing about in sandals among the knights whose armour flashed by candlelight. There was even a Franciscan bishop wearing grey with a red hat. The copes and mitres were almost all of solid gold, crusted with diamonds, and there was such a putting of them on and taking of them off that the whole cathedral rustled. As for the Latin, it was talked at such a speed that the rafters rang with genitive plurals, and there was such a prelatical issuing of admonitions, exhortations, and benedictions that it was a wonder the whole congregation did not go to heaven on the spot. Even the Pope, who was as keen as anybody that the thing should go with a swing, had kindly sent a number of indulgences for everybody he could think of. After the marriage came the wedding feast. King Pellinore and his queen, who had stood hand in hand throughout the previous ceremony, with St. Turtlebach and Mother Morland behind them, quite dazzled with candlelight and incense and aspersion, were propped up in the place of honour and served by Arthur himself on bended knee. You can imagine how charmed Mother Morland was. There was peacock pie, jellied eels, Devonshire cream, curried porpoise, iced fruit salad, and 2,000 side dishes. There were speeches, songs, healths, and bumpers. A special courier arrived at full speed from Northumberland and delivered a message to the bridegroom. He said, "Best wishes from Merlin. Stop. The present is under the throne. Stop. Love to Aglovale, Percival, Lamorack, Dornar." When the excitement over the message had died down and the wedding present had been found, some round games were immediately arranged for the younger members of the party. In these, a small page of the king's household excelled. He was a son of Arthur's ally at Bedegraine, King Ban of Benwick, and his name was Lancelot. There was bobbing for apples, shovel-board, titter-totter, and a puppet or motion play called Mac and the Shepherds, which made everybody laugh. St. Tordelbach disgraced himself by stunning one of the fatter bishops with his shillelagh during an argument about the bull called Laudabiliter. Finally, at a late hour, the party broke up after a feeling rendering of Auld Lang Syne. King Pellinore was sick, and the new Queen Pellinore put him to bed, explaining that he was overexcited. Far away in Northumberland, Merlin jumped out of bed. They had been out at dawn and sunset to watch the geese, and he had gone to his rest very tired. But suddenly he had remembered it in his sleep, the simplest thing. It was Arthur's mother's name, which he had forgotten to mention in the confusion. There he had been chattering away about Uther Pendragon and round tables and battles and Guinevere and sword sheaths and things past and things to come, but he had forgotten the most important thing of all. Arthur's mother was Igraine, that very Igraine who had been captured at Tintagel, the one that the Orkney children had been talking about in the Round Tower at the beginning of this book. Arthur had been begotten on the night when Uther Pendragon burst into her castle. Since Uther naturally could not marry her until she was out of mourning for the Earl, the boy had been born too soon. That was why Arthur had been sent away to be brought up by Sir Ector. Not a soul had known where he was sent except for Merlin and Uther, and now Uther was dead. Even Igraine had not known. Merlin stood swaying in his bare feet on the cold floor. If only he had spun himself to Carlion at once, before it was too late. But the old man was tired and muddled with his backside, and dreams were in his noddle. He thought it would do in the morning, could not remember whether he was in the future or the past. He put the veined hand blindly towards the bedclothes, the image of Nimue already weaving itself in his sleepy brain. He tumbled in. The beard went under the covering, the nose into the pillow. Merlin was asleep. King Arthur sat back in the great hall, which was empty. A few of his favourite knights had been taking their nightcap with him, but now he was alone. It had been a tiring day, although he had reached the full strength of his youth, and he leaned his head against the back of his throne, thinking about the events of the marriage. He had been fighting on and off ever since he had come to be king by drawing the sword out of the stone, and the anxiety of these campaigns had grown him into a splendid fellow. At last it looked as if he might have peace. He thought of the joys of peace, of being married himself one day, as Merlin had prophesied, and of having a home. He thought of Nimue at this, and then of any beautiful woman. He fell asleep. He woke with a start, to find a black-haired, blue-eyed beauty in front of him, who was wearing a crown. The four wild children from the north were standing behind their mother, shy and defiant, and she was folding up a tape. Queen Morgause of the Out Isles had stayed away from the feasting on purpose, had chosen her moment with the utmost care. This was the first time that the young king had seen her, and she knew that she was looking her best. It is impossible to explain how these things begin. Perhaps the spancel had a strength in it. Perhaps it was because she was twice his age, so that she had twice the power of his weapons. Perhaps it was because Arthur was always a simple fellow, who took people at their own valuation easily. Perhaps it was because he had never known a mother of his own, so that the role of mother love, as she stood with her children behind her, took him between wind and water. Whatever the explanation may have been, the Queen of Air and Darkness had a baby by her half-brother 9 months later. It was called Mordred. And this, as Merlin drew it later, was what the magician called its pied-de-grue. Merlin's pedigree was a diagram which showed the following. The Earl of Cornwall married Igraine and had three daughters, Morgan le Fay, Elaine, and Morgause. King Uther Pendragon stole Igraine from the Earl of Cornwall and had a son by her, Arthur. Morgause married King Lot of Orkney and had four sons, Gawain, Agravaine, Gaheris, and Gareth. Morgause committed adultery with her half-brother, Arthur, and had a son by him, Mordred. Even if you've read it twice, like something in a history lesson, this pedigree is a vital part of the tragedy of King Arthur. It is why Sir Thomas Malory called his very long book The Death of Arthur. Although 9/10 of the story seems to be about knights jousting and quests for the Holy Grail and things of that sort, the narrative is a whole, and it deals with the reasons why the young man came to grief at the end. It is the tragedy, the Aristotelian and comprehensive tragedy, of sin coming home to roost. That is why we have to take note of the parentage of Arthur's son Mordred, and to remember when the time comes that the king had slept with his own sister. He did not know he was doing so, and perhaps it may have been due to her. But it seems in tragedy, that innocence is not enough. Explicit liber secundus. Incipit liber tertius. The ill-made knight.
Nay, said Sir Lancelot, for once shamed may never be recovered.
Chapter 1. In the castle of Benwick, the French boy was looking at his face in the polished surface of a kettle hat. It flashed in the sunlight with the stubborn gleam of metal. It was practically the same as the steel helmet which soldiers still wear, and it did not make a good mirror, but it was the best he could get. He turned the hat in various directions, hoping to get an average idea of his face from the different distortions which the bulges made. He was trying to find out what he was, and he was afraid of what he would find. The boy thought that there was something wrong with him. All through his life, even when he was a great man with the world at his feet, he was to feel this gap, something at the bottom of his heart of which he was aware and ashamed, but which he did not understand. There is no need for us to try to understand it. We do not have to dabble in a place which he preferred to keep secret. The armoury, where the boy stood, was lined with weapons of war. For the last 2 hours he had been whirling a pair of dumbbells in the air, he called them poises, and singing to himself a song with no words and no tune. He was 15. He'd just come back from England, where his father, King Ban of Benwick, had been helping the English king to quell a rebellion. You remember that Arthur wanted to catch his knights young, to train them for the Round Table, and that he had noticed Lancelot at the feast, because he was winning most of the games. Lancelot, swinging his dumbbells fiercely and making his wordless noise, had been thinking of King Arthur with all his might. He was in love with him. That was why he had been swinging the poises. He had been remembering all the words of the only conversation which he had held with his hero. The king had called him over when they were embarking for France, after he had kissed King Ban goodbye, and they had gone alone into a corner of the ship. The heraldic sails of Ban's fleet, and the sailors in the rigging, and the armed turrets and archers and seagulls like flake white, had been a background to their conversation. "Lance," the king had said, "come here a moment, will you?"
"Sir."
"I was watching you playing games at the feast."
"Sir?"
"You seemed to win most of them." Lancelot squinted down his nose. "I want to get hold of a lot of people who are good at games, to help with an idea I have. It is for the time when I am a real king, and I've got this kingdom settled. I was wondering whether you would care to help, when you're old enough." The boy had made a sort of wriggle, and had suddenly flashed his eyes at the speaker. "It is about knights," Arthur had continued. "I want to have an order of chivalry, like the Order of the Garter, which goes about fighting against might. Would you like to be one of those?"
"Yes."
The king had looked at him closely, unable to see whether he was pleased or frightened or merely being polite. "Do you understand what I'm talking about?" Lancelot had taken the wind out of his sails.
"We call it Fort Main in France," he had explained. "The man with the strongest arm in a clan gets made the head of it and does what he pleases. That is why we call it Fort Main. You want to put an end to the strong arm by having a band of knights who believe in justice rather than strength. Yes, I would like to be one of those very much. I must grow up first. Thank you. Now I must say goodbye."
So they had sailed away from England, the boy standing in the front of the ship and refusing to look back, because he did not want to show his feelings. He had already fallen in love with Arthur on the night of the wedding feast, and he carried with him in his heart to France the picture of that bright northern king at supper, flushed and glorious from his wars. Behind the black eyes which were searching intently in the kettle hat, there was a dream which had come to him the previous night. 700 years ago, or it may have been 1500 according to Mallory's notation, people took dreams as seriously as the psychiatrists do today, and Lancelot's had been a disturbing one. It was not disturbing because of anything it might mean, for he had not the least idea of its meaning, but because it had left him with a sense of loss. This was what it was. Lancelot and his young brother, Ector de Maris, had been sitting in two chairs. They got out of these chairs and were mounted on two horses. Lancelot said, "Go we, and seek that which we shall not find." So they did. But a man or a power set upon Lancelot, and beat him and despoiled him, and clothed him in another array which was full of knots, and made him ride on an ass instead of on the horse. Then there was a beautiful well, with the fairest waters he had ever seen, and he got off his ass to drink out of it. It seemed to him that there could be nothing in the world more beautiful than to drink of this well. But as soon as he stooped his lips towards it, the water sank away. It went right down into the barrel of the well, sinking and sinking from him so that he could not get it. It made him feel desolate to be abandoned by the water of the well. Arthur and the well and the dumbbells which were to make him worthy of Arthur, and the ache in his tired arms from swinging them, all these were at the back of the boy's mind as he tilted the tin hat backward and forward between his fingers. But there was a more insistent thought in his head also. It was a thought about the face in the metal, and about the thing which must have gone wrong in the depths of his spirit to make a face like that. He was not a self-deceiver. He knew that whichever way he turned the morion, it would tell him the same story. He had already decided that when he was a grown knight he would give himself a melancholy title. He was the eldest son, so he was bound to be knighted, but he would not call himself Sir Lancelot. He would call himself the Chevalier Malfait, the ill-made knight. So far as he could see, and he felt that there must be some reason for it somewhere, the boy's face was as ugly as a monster's in the king's menagerie. He looked like an African ape. Chapter 2 Lancelot ended by being the greatest knight King Arthur had. He was a sort of Bradman, top of the battling averages. Tristram and Lamorack were second and third. But you have to remember that people can't be good at cricket unless they teach themselves to be so, and the jousting was an art, just as cricket is. It was like cricket in many ways. There was a scorer's pavilion at a tournament with a real scorer inside it, who made marks on the parchment just like the mark for one run which is made by the cricket scorer today. The people walking round the ground in their best frocks from grandstand to refreshment tent must have found the fighting very like the game. It took a frightfully long time. Sir Lancelot's innings frequently lasted all day if he were battling against a good knight, and the movements had a feeling of slow motion because of the weight of armour. When the sword play had begun, the combatants stood opposite each other in the green acre like batsman and bowler, except that they stood closer together. And perhaps Sir Gawain would start with an in-swinger, which Sir Lancelot would put away to leg with a beautiful leg glide, and then Lancelot would reply with a yorker under Gawain's guard, it was called foining, and all the people round the field would clap. King Arthur might turn to Guinevere in the pavilion and remark that the great man's footwork was as lovely as ever. The knights had little curtains on the back of their helms to keep the hot sun off the metal, like the handkerchiefs which cricketers will sometimes arrange behind their caps today. Knightly exercise was as much an art as cricket is, and perhaps the only way in which Lancelot did not resemble Bradman was that he was more graceful. He did not have that crouching on the bat and hopping out to the pitch of the ball. He was more like Woolley. But you can't be like Woolley by simply sitting still and wanting to be so. The armoury, where the small boy who was later to be Sir Lancelot was standing with his morion, was the largest single room in the castle of Benwick.
It was to be the room in which this boy was to spend most of his waking hours for the next 3 years. The rooms of the main castle, which he could see from the windows, were mostly small, because people can't afford to build for luxury when they're making a fortification. Round the inner fort, with its small rooms, there was a wide byre or shell keep, into which the castle herds were driven during a siege. This was surrounded by a high wall with towers, and on the inner side of this wall, the big rooms which were needed for stores, barns, barracks, and stables were built. The armory was one of these rooms. It stood between the stables for 50 horses and the cowsheds. The best family armor, the bits which were actually in use, was kept in a little room in the castle itself, and it was only the arms of the troops, and the spare parts of the family stuff, and the things which were needed for gymnastics, practice, or physical training, which reposed in the armoury. Under the raftered ceiling, and the nearest to it, there hung or leaned a collection of bannerets and pennoncels, blazoned with the ban charges, France Ancient, as they're now called, which would be needed on various occasions. Along the wall there were tilting lances resting horizontally on nails so that they should not warp. These looked like bars for exercise in a gymnasium. In one corner, a collection of old lances which had already warped or got injured in some way, but which might still be useful for something, were standing upright. A rack, running the whole length of the second main wall, held the infantry issue of male habergeons with mittens, spears, morions, and Bordeaux swords. King Ban was fortunate in living at Benwick, for the Bordeaux swords were local and particularly good. Then there were harness barrels in which the armour was packed in hay for expeditions overseas. Some of it was still packed from the last expedition, and a curious mixture it was. Uncle Dapp, who looked after the armoury, had been unpacking one of the barrels to make an inventory of its contents, and had gone away in despair on discovering 10 pounds of dates and 5 loaves of sugar in it. It must have been some sort of honey sugar, unless it was loaf sugar brought back from the Crusades. He had left his list beside the barrel, and this recorded, among other articles, a salad garnished with goldi, 3 pair gantelets, a vestment, a mezbuki, an outer cloth, a pair of brigandines, a pissing basin of silver, 10 shirties for my lord, a jacket of leather, and a baggie of chessmen. Then, in an alcove formed by the harness barrels, there was a set of shelves which formed the dispensary for sick armour. On the shelves there were huge bottles of olive oil. Nowadays they prefer a mineral oil for armour, but they did not understand such niceties in Lancelot's time, together with boxes of fine sand for polishing, bags of brigandine nails at 11 shillings and 8 pence the 20,000, rivets, spare rings for chain mail, leather skins for cutting new straps and bases for the knee harness, together with 1,000 other details then fascinating, but now lost to us. There were gambesons like the pads which the goalkeeper wears in hockey, or like the quilted protections which Americans have at football. In various corners there were pushed, so as to leave a free space in the middle of the room, a collection of gymnastic apparatus such as quintains and so on, while Uncle Dapp's desk stood near the door. On the desk there were splattering quill pens, blotting sand, sticks for beating Lancelot when he was stupid, and notes in unutterable confusion as to which jupons had lately been pawned. Pawning was a great institution for valuable armour, and which helms had been brought up to date with a glancing surface, and whose vambrace stood in need of repair, and what had been paid to whom for forbishing which when. Most of the accounts were wrongly added up. 3 years may seem a long time for a boy to spend in one room, if he only goes out of it to eat and sleep and to practice tilting in the field. It is even difficult to imagine a boy who would do it, unless you realise from the start that Lancelot was not romantic and debonair.
Tennyson and the Pre-Raphaelites would have found it difficult to recognise this rather sullen and unsatisfactory child with the ugly face, who did not disclose to anybody that he was living on dreams and prayers. They might have wondered what store of ferocity he had against himself that could set him to break his own body so young. They might have wondered why he was so strange. To begin with, he had to spend the weary months charging against Uncle Dap with a blunt spear under his arm. Uncle Dap, armed cap-a-pie, would sit on a stool, and Lancelot, with the morn-headed spear, would charge and charge against him, learning the best lodges on armour for a point. Then there were lonely hours with poises, with many other hours out of doors, before he was even allowed to touch real arms, in which he learned various kinds of throwing, casting with the sling stick, or the casting spear, and tossing the bar. After that, after a year of toil, there was his promotion to the Pell Quintain. It was a stake driven upright in the ground, and he had to fight against it with sword and shield, rather like shadow boxing or using a punch ball. He had to use arms for this exercise, which weighed twice as much as the ordinary sword and shield. 60 pounds was considered a good weight for the arms used on the Pell Quintain, so that, when he did come at length to the usual weapons, he would wield them featly. They would seem light by comparison. The final stage of breaking to the cricket standard was by mock combats. In these at last, and after all the bitter setbacks of discipline, he was allowed to fight battles which were nearly real ones, against his brother and cousins. The combats were held under strict rules. They might begin with a cast of the spear blunted, followed by 7 strokes with the sword, point and edge rebated, without close or griping one another with the handles, upon pain of punishment, as the judges for the time being shall think a requisite. It was not lawful in these matches to foin, that is to make a thrust of the point. Finally, there was swashbuckling. The now vigorous boy might go at his companions harum-scarum with sword and buckler. If you have been down in one of the old-fashioned diving suits which used to be standard in the Royal Navy before frogmen and free diving came along, you will know why divers move slowly. A diver has 40 pounds of lead on each foot and 2 plaques of lead, each weighing 50 pounds, one on his back and one on his chest. These are apart from the weight of the suit and the helmet. Except when he is in the sea, he weighs twice as much as a man. When he has to step over a rope or an air tube on deck, it's hard work, like climbing a wall. If you push him from in front, the weight behind him tends to take over so that he might fall backwards. The same thing happens vice versa. Practiced divers become adept at dealing with these handicaps and can hoist those 40-pound feet up and down the ship's ladder fairly nimbly, but an amateur half kills himself with the mere toil of movement. Lancelot, like the diver, had to learn to be nimble against the force of gravity. Knights in armour were like divers in more ways than one. Apart from their helmets and encumbrances and the difficulty of breathing, they had to be dressed in their suits by kind and careful assistance. They had to rely on these assistants to do it properly. A diver puts his life in the hands of the ratings who are dressing him. These young men, like pages or squires, mother him with great tenderness and concentration and with a sort of protective respect. They always address him by his title, not by his name. They say, "Sit down, diver," or "Now the left foot, diver," or "Diver two, can you hear me on the intercom?" It is good to put your life in other people's hands. 3 years of it. The other boys did not worry, for they had other things to think about, but for the ugly one, it was the whole of an obscure and mystic life. He had to perfect himself for Arthur, as somebody who was good at games, and he had to think about the theories of chivalry even when he was in bed at night. He had to teach himself to possess a sound opinion on hundreds of disputed points, on the proper length of weapons, or the cut of a mantling, or the articulation of a pauldron, or whether cedar wood was better than ash for spears, as Chaucer seems to have believed. Here is a short example of the problems of chivalry, which he thought about in his early times. There was a knight once called Reynaud de Roye, who had a tilting match with another one called John de Holland. Reynaud purposely fastened his tilting helm, the huge straw-padded drum which sometimes fitted over the helmet proper, so that it was loose. When John of Holland's spear struck it, it simply fell off. This meant that the helm came off Reynaud instead of Reynaud coming off his horse. An effective trick, but a dangerous one. The whole of chivalry argued about it for a long time, some saying that it was unsporting, some that it was fair but too risky, and some that it was a good idea. 3 years of discipline made Lancelot not a merry heart and a capacity for singing Tirra Lirra. Out of a lifetime, which at his age must have seemed to stretch little more than a week ahead, he gave 36 months to another man's idea, because he was in love with it. He supported himself, meanwhile, on daydreams. He wanted to be the best knight in the world, so that Arthur would love him in return. And he wanted one other thing which was still possible in those days. He wanted, through his purity and excellence, to be able to perform some ordinary miracle, to heal a blind man or something like that, for instance. Chapter 3. There was a feature about the great families which centred round the doom of Arthur. All three had a resident genius of the family, halfway between a tutor and a confidant, who affected the character of the children in each. At Sir Ector's castle there had been Merlin, who was the main influence in Arthur's life. In lonely and distant Lothian there had been St. Turtlebach, whose warlike philosophy must have had something to do with the clannishness of Gawain and his brothers. In King Ban's castle, there was an uncle of Lancelot's whose name was Gwenbors. Actually, he was the old man we have met, known to everybody as Uncle Dap, but his given name was Gwenbors. In those days, you generally named your children in the same way as we name foxhounds and foals today. If you happened to be Queen Morgause and had 4 children, you put a G in all their names, Gawain, Agravain, Gaheris, and Gareth. And naturally, if your brothers happened to be called Ban and Bor, you were doomed to be called Gwenbors yourself. It made it easier to remember who you were. Uncle Dap was the only one in the family who took Lancelot seriously, and Lancelot was the one who was serious about Uncle Dap. It was easy not to be serious about the old fellow, for he was that peculiar creation which ignorant people laugh at, a genuine maestro. His branch of learning was chivalry. There was not a piece of armour proofed in Europe but what Uncle Dap had a theory about it. He was furious with the new Gothic style, with its ridges and scallop patterns and fluting. He considered it ridiculous to wear armour like the ropework on a Nelson sideboard, for it was obvious that every groove would be liable to hold a point. The whole object of good armour, he said, was to throw the point off. And when he thought of the people in Germany making their horrible furrows, he nearly went frantic. There was nothing in heraldry which he did not know. If anybody committed any of the grosser errors, such as putting metal on metal or colour on colour, he became electrified with passion. His long white moustaches quivered at their tips like antennae, the ends of his fingers came together in gestures of the wildest passion, and he waved his arms and jumped up and down and wagged his eyebrows and almost fizzed. Nobody can be a maestro without being subject to these excitements, so Lancelot seldom minded when he got his face slapped in a melee about shields cut à bouche or about whether it was a good idea to have a guige on your shield or not. Sometimes Uncle Dap was tantalised into beating him, but he bore that also. In those days they did. One reason for not minding Uncle Dap's transports was that everything the boy wanted could be learned from him. He was not only a distinguished clerk and authority on his own subjects, he was also one of the finest swordsmen in France. It was for this, really, that the boy had attached himself. It was in order to raise and trace and foin under the brutal tuition of genius, in order to hold out a heavy sword at arm's length in a lunge until he felt he would split in half, only to have Uncle Dap catch hold of his point and pull him into a crueler stretch. Ever since he could remember, there had been the excited man with the eyes of blue steel, jumping up and down and snapping his fingers and shouting out as if life itself depended on it, "Doublé! Dédoublé! Dégagé! Un, deux!" One fine day in late summer, Lancelot was sitting in the armory with his uncle. In the big room there was a lot of dust dancing in the sunbeams, dust which they had themselves been stirring up a moment before, and round the walls there were the ranks of polished armour and the racks of spears and helms and morions hanging on pegs. There were misericords and harness and the various banners and pennoncels blazoned with the ban chargers. The two fencers had sat down to rest after an exciting bout, and Uncle Dap was blown. Lancelot was 18 now. He was a better fencer than his maestro, though Uncle Dap would not admit it, and his pupil tactfully pretended that he was not. A page came in while they were still panting, and told him that he was wanted by his mother. "Why?" The page said that a gentleman had arrived who wanted to see him, and the Queen had said that he was to come at once. Queen Elaine was sitting in the solar, where she had been doing tapestry work, and her two guests were sitting on either side of her. She was not the Elaine who had been one of the Cornwall sisters. It was a popular name in those days, and several women in the Mort d'Arthur had it, particularly as some of its manuscript sources have got mixed up. The three grown-ups at the long table looked like a row of examiners in the dim room. One of the guests was an elderly gentleman with a white beard and pointed hat, and the other was a handsome minx with an olive complexion and plucked eyebrows. They all three looked at Lancelot, and the old gentleman spoke first.
"Hum." They waited. "You called him Galahad," said the old gentleman. "His first name was Galahad," he added, "and now he is Lancelot, since he was confirmed."
"However did you know?"
"It can't be helped," said Merlin. "It is one of those things one does know, and there's an end on't. Now, let me see. What are the other things I was supposed to tell you?"
The young lady with the plucked eyebrows put her hand before her mouth and yawned gracefully like a cat.
"He will get the hope of his heart 30 years from now, and he will be the best knight in the world."
"Shall I live to see it?" asked Queen Elaine.
Merlin scratched his head, gave it a bump on the top with his knuckles, and replied, "Yes."
"Well," said the Queen, "it is all very wonderful, I must say. Do you hear that, Lance? You're to be the best knight in the world."
The boy asked, "Have you come from the court of King Arthur?"
"Yes."
"Is everything well?"
"Yes. He sends you his love."
"Is the king happy?"
"Very happy. Guinevere sent her love too."
"Who is Guinevere?"
"Good gracious," exclaimed the magician. "Didn't you know about that?" "No, of course not. I've been getting bejingled in my brains."
Here he glanced at the beautiful lady, as if she might be responsible for the jingling, which she was. She was Nimue, and he had fallen in love with her at last.
"Guinevere," said Nimue, "is Arthur's new queen. They have been married for some time."
"Her father is King Leodegrance," explained Merlin. "He gave Arthur a present of a round table when they were married, and 100 knights to go with it.
There is room at the table for 150.
Lancelot said,
Oh.
The king meant to tell you, said Merlin. Perhaps the messenger got drowned on the way over. There may have been a storm. He really did mean to tell you.
Oh, said the boy for the second time. Merlin began to talk quickly, because he saw that it was a difficult situation. From Lancelot's face he could not tell whether he was hurt or whether it was like that always.
He has only managed to fill in 29 of the seats so far, he said. There is room for 21 more. Plenty of room. All the knights' names are written on them in gold.
There was a pause, during which nobody knew what to say. Then Lancelot cleared his throat.
There was a boy, he said, when I was in England. His name was Gawain. Has he been made one of the knights of the table?
Merlin looked guilty and nodded his head.
He was created on the day Arthur was married.
I see. There was another long pause.
This lady, said Merlin, feeling that he had better fill in the silence, is called Nimue. I am in love with her. We are having a sort of honeymoon together, only it is a magical one, and now we shall have to be off to Cornwall. I'm sorry we could not visit you for longer.
My dear Merlin, exclaimed the Queen, but surely you will stay the night.
No, no, thank you. Thank you very much. We are in a hurry just now.
You will have a glass of something before you leave?
No, thank you. It is very kind of you, but really, we must be off. We have some magic to attend to in Cornwall.
Such a short visit, began the Queen.
Merlin cut her short by standing up and taking Nimue's hand in his.
Goodbye now,
he said with determination, and in a couple of spins they were both gone. Their bodies were gone, but the magician's voice remained in the air.
That's that, they could hear him saying in a relieved tone. Now then, my angel, what about that place I was telling you of in Cornwall? The one with the magical cave in it?
Lancelot went back to Uncle Dapp in the armory with slow steps. He stood in front of his uncle and bit his lip. I am going to England, he said. Uncle Dapp looked at him in amazement, but said nothing. I shall start this evening.
It seems sudden, said Uncle Dapp. Your mother does not usually make up her mind so quickly.
My mother does not know.
Do you mean that you are going to run away?
If I told my mother and father, there would only be a fuss, he said. It is not that I am running away. I shall come back again. But I must go to England as quick as I can.
Do you expect me to tell your mother?
Yes, I do. Uncle Dapp gnawed the ends of his moustache and wrung his hands.
If they get to know that I could have prevented it, he said, Ban will cut off my head.
They will not know, said the boy indifferently, and he went away to arrange about his packing. A week later, Lancelot and Uncle Dapp were sitting in a peculiar boat in the middle of the English Channel. The boat had a sort of castle at each end. There was another castle halfway up the single mast, which gave it the appearance of a dovecote. It had flags fore and aft. The one gay sail had a cross potent on it, while an enormous streamer floated from the top of the mast. There were 8 oars, and the 2 passengers were seasick. Chapter 4. The hero-worshipper rode towards Camelot with a bitter heart. It was hard for him at 18 to have given his life to a king only to be forgotten, hard to have spent those sorrowful hours with the heavy arms in the dust of the armory only to see Sir Gawain knighted first,
Hardest of all to have broken his body for the older man's ideal, only to find this mincing wife stepping in at the end of it to snatch away his love at no cost at all. Lancelot was jealous of Guinevere, and he was ashamed of himself for being so. Uncle Dapp rode behind the grieving boy in silence. He knew a thing which the other was still too green to know, that he had taught the finest knight in Europe. Like an excited tit which had nursed a cuckoo, Uncle Dapp fluttered along behind his prodigy. He was carrying the fighting harness, which was strapped up in apple-pie order according to his own dodges and wrinkles, for from now on, he was Lancelot's squire. They came to a clearing in the wood, and a little stream ran through the middle. There was a ford here, and the stream ran tinkling over the clean stones only a few inches deep. The sun shone down into the clearing. Some wood-pigeons sang drowsily their "Take two cows, Taffy," and on the other side of the musical water there was an enormous knight in black armour with his tilting helm in position. He sat motionless on a black charger, and his shield was still in its canvas case. It was impossible to read his blazon. Being so still, so portly in his iron sheath, and having the great blind helm over his head so that he had no proper face, he had a look of danger about him. You did not know what he was thinking, nor what action he might be going to take. He was a menace. Lancelot halted, and so did Uncle Dapp. The Black Knight walked his horse into the shallow water and drew rein in front of them. He raised his lance in a gesture of salute, then pointed with it to a place behind Lancelot's back. Either he was telling him to go home again, or else he was pointing out a good position from which they could start their charges. Whichever the case might be, Lancelot saluted with his gauntlet and turned round to go to the place. He took one of his spears from Uncle Dapp, pulled his tilting helm round in front of him, it had been hanging behind on a chain, and lifted the steel turret into position on his head. He laced it on. Now he too had become a man without an expression. The two knights faced each other from opposite ends of the little glade. Then, although neither of them had so far spoken a word, they feuted their spears, put spurs to their horses, and began to charge. Uncle Dapp, drawn up safely behind a nearby tree, could hardly contain his delight. He knew what was going to happen to the Black Knight, although Lancelot did not know, and he began to snap his fingers. The first time you do a thing, it is often exciting. To go alone in an aeroplane for the first time used to be so exciting that it nearly choked you. Lancelot had never ridden a serious joust before, and although he had charged at hundreds of quintains and thousands of rings, he had never taken his life in his hands in earnest. In the first moment of the charge he felt to himself, "Well, now I am off. Nothing can help me now." In the second moment he settled down to behave automatically, in the same way as he had always behaved with the quintain and the rings. The point of his spear took the Black Knight under the rim of his shoulder harness at exactly the right place. His mount was in full gallop, and the Black Knights were still in a canter. The Black Knight and his horse revolved rapidly toward their sinister side, left the ground together in a handsome parabola, and came down again with a clash. As Lancelot rode by, he could see them sprawling on the ground together, with the knight's broken lance between the horse's legs, and one flashing horseshoe tearing the canvas from the fallen shield. The man and the horse were mixed together. Each was afraid of the other, and each was kicking against the other in the effort to be parted. Then the horse got up on its forelegs, its haunches heaved upright, and the knight sat up, lifting one steel gauntlet as if to rub his head. Lancelot reined in and rode back to him. Generally, when one knight had given another a fall with the lance, the fallen one used to lose his temper, blame the fall on his horse, and insist upon fighting it out with swords on foot.
The usual excuse was to say, "The son of a mare hath failed me, but I wot well my father's sword never shall."
The Black Knight, however, did not do the usual thing. He was evidently a more cheerful kind of person than the colour of his armour would suggest, for he sat up and blew through the split of his helm, making a note of surprise and admiration. Then he took off the helm and mopped his brow. The shield, whose cover the horse's hoof had torn, bore "Or a Dragon Rampant Gules." Lancelot threw his spear into a bush, got off his horse very quickly, and knelt down beside the knight. All his love was back again inside him. It was typical of Arthur not to lose his temper, typical of him to sit on the ground making noises of admiration when he had just been given a great fall. "Sir," said Lancelot, taking off his own helm with a humble gesture, and he bowed his head in the French fashion. The king began scrambling to his feet in great excitement. "Lancelot!" he exclaimed. "Why, it's the boy Lancelot! You are the king's son of Benwick! I remember seeing you when he came over for the Battle of Bedegraine. What a fall! I never saw anything like it! Where did you learn to do this? It was terrific! Were you coming to my court? How is King Ban? How is your charming mother? Really, my dear chap, this is magnificent!" Lancelot looked up at the breathless king, who held out both hands to help him to his feet, and his jealousy and grief were over. They caught their horses and jogged off toward the palace side by side, forgetting Uncle Dap. They had so much to say to each other that they both talked all the time. Lancelot gave imaginary messages from King Ban or from Queen Elaine, and Arthur talked about how Gawain had killed a lady. He told how King Pellinore had got so courageous since his marriage that he had killed King Lot of Orkney by mistake in a tournament, and how the Round Table was going as well as could be expected, but very slowly, and how, now that Lancelot had arrived, everything would come right before they knew where they were. He was knighted the first day. He might have been knighted at any time during the past 2 years, but he had refused to be done by anybody except Arthur, and he was introduced to Guinevere the same evening. There is a story that her hair was yellow, but it was not. It was so black that it was startling, and her blue eyes, deep and clear, had a sort of fearlessness which was startling too. She was surprised by the young man's twisted face, but not frightened. "Now," said the king, putting their hands together, "this is Lancelot, the one I told you about. He is going to be the best knight I have. I never saw such a fall as he gave me. I want you to be kind to him, Gwen. His father is one of my oldest friends." He kissed the queen's hand coldly. He did not notice anything particular about her, because his mind was filled with previous pictures which he had made for himself. There was no room for pictures of what she was really like. He thought of her only as the person who had robbed him, and since robbers are deceitful, designing, and heartless people, he thought of her as these. "How do you do?" asked the queen. Arthur said, "We shall have to tell him what's been happening since he went away. What a lot of things to tell! Where can we begin?" "Begin with the table," said Lancelot.
"Oh, dear."
The queen laughed and smiled at the new knight. "Arthur thinks about it all the time," she said. "He even dreams about it at night. He won't be able to tell you unless he talks for a week."
"It's not going badly," said the king. "You can't expect a thing like that to go smoothly the whole time. The idea is there, and people are beginning to understand it, and that's the great thing. I'm sure it'll work."
"What about the Orkney faction?"
"They will come round in time."
"Is that Gawain?" inquired Lancelot. "What is the matter with the Orkney faction?"
The king looked uncomfortable. He said, "The real matter with them is Morgause, their mother.
She brought them up with so little love or security that they find it difficult to understand warm-hearted people themselves. They're suspicious and frightened. They don't get hold of the ideas I wanted them to do. We have three of them here, Gawain, Gaheris, and Agravain. It's not their fault.
Arthur had his first Pentecost fast the year we were married, explained Guinevere, and sent everybody out looking for good adventures to see how the idea would work. When they came back, Gawain had cut a lady's head off, and even dear old Pellinore had failed to rescue a damsel in distress. Arthur was furious about it.
It is not Gawain's fault, said the king. He is a nice fellow. I like him. It is the fault of that woman.
I hope things have got better since then.
Yes, it is slow work, of course, but I am sure we could say that things have got better.
Did Pellinore repent?
Arthur said. Pellinore repented, yes. There was not much to repent. It was one of his muddles. But the trouble is that he has got so valiant since he married the Queen's daughter of Flanders that he has taken to jousting in earnest, and quite often wins. I was telling you how he killed King Lot one day when they were having a practice. It has created a great deal of ill feeling. The Orkney children have sworn to revenge their father's death, and they're out on the warpath for poor old Pellinore's blood. I'm having difficulty in making them behave.
Lancelot will help you, said the Queen. It will be nice to have an old friend to help.
Yes, it will be nice. Now, Lance, I expect you'll want to see your room.
It was the second half of summer, and the amateur falconers in Camelot were bringing their peregrines to the last stages of their training. If you're a clever falconer, you get your hawk on the wing quickly. If you're not, you're apt to make mistakes, and the result is that the hawk does not finish her training for some time. So all the falconers in Camelot were trying to show that they were clever ones by getting their hawks entered as quickly as possible. And in all directions, if you went for a walk in the fields, there were atrabilious hawk masters stretching out their creances and quarrelling with their assistants. Hawking, as James I pointed out, is an extreme stirring up of passions. It is because the hawks themselves are furious creatures, and the people who associate with them catch it. Arthur presented Sir Lancelot with an intermewed gerfalcon with which to keep himself amused. This was a great compliment, for gerfalcons were only supposed to be used by kings. At any rate, that is what the Abbess Juliana Berners tells us, perhaps incorrectly. An emperor was allowed an eagle. A king could have a gerfalcon, and after that there was the peregrine for an earl, the merlin for a lady, the goshawk for a yeoman, the sparrowhawk for a priest, and the musket for a holy water clerk. Lancelot was pleased with his present, and settled down busily in competition with the other angry falconers, who were hard at work criticising each other's methods and sending each other messages of sugary venom and getting yellow about the eyeballs. The gerfalcon, which had been given to Lancelot, was not properly through her moult. Like Hamlet, she was fat and scant of breath. Her long confinement in the mews while she moulted had got her into a sulky and temperamental state. So Lancelot had to fly her on the creance for several days before he could be sure that she was safe to the lure. If you have ever flown a hawk on a creance, which is a long line tied to the hawk's jesses so that she cannot fly away, you know what a nuisance the thing can be. Nowadays people use a fishing reel, which makes it easier to stretch it out and to wind it up. But in Lancelot's day there were no good reels, and you simply had to wind your creance into a ball, like string. There were two main horrors to which it was subject, the first of which was the horror peculiar to all balls of string, that they invariably become tangles instead of balls. The second was that if you flew the hawk in any field which had not been carefully mowed, the string became wound round thistles or tufts of grass, thus checking the hawk and doing damage to its training. So Lancelot and all the other angry men went circling round Camelot in a bitter atmosphere of knots and competition and baiting hawks. King Arthur had asked his wife to be kind to the young man. She was fond of her husband, and she realized that she had come between him and his friend. She was not such a fool as to try to atone to Lancelot for this, but she had taken a fancy for him as himself. She liked his broken face, however hideous it was, and Arthur had asked her to be kind. There was a shortage of assistants in Camelot for the hawking, because there were so many people at it, so Guinevere began going with Lancelot to help him with the balls of string. He did not take much notice of the woman. "Here comes that woman," he would remark to himself, or "there goes that woman." He was already deep in the hawking atmosphere, which was only partly an affair for females, and he seldom thought of her more than that. He had grown into a beautifully polite youth, in spite of his ugliness, and he was too self-conscious to allow himself to have petty thoughts for long. His jealousy had turned into unconsciousness of her existence. He went on with his hawk mastery, thanking her politely for her help and accepting it with courtesy. One day there was particular trouble with a thistle, and he had miscalculated the amount of food which ought to have been given the day before. The gerfalcon was in a foul temper, and Lancelot caught its mood. Guinevere, who was not particularly good with hawks and had no special interest in them, was frightened by his frowning brow, and because she was frightened, she became clumsy. She was sweetly trying her best to help, but she knew that she was not clever at falconry, and there was confusion in her mind. Very carefully and kindly, and with the best intentions, she wound the creance up quite wrong. He took the wretched ball away from her with a gesture which was almost rough. "That's no good," he said, and he began to unwind her hopeful work with angry fingers. His eyebrows made a horrible scowl. There was a moment in which everything stood still. Guinevere stood, hurt in her heart. Lancelot, sensing her stillness, stood also. The hawk stopped baiting, and the leaves did not rustle. The young man knew, in this moment, that he had hurt a real person of his own age. He saw in her eyes that she thought he was hateful, and that he had surprised her badly. She had been giving kindness, and he had returned it with unkindness. But the main thing was that she was a real person. She was not a minx, not deceitful, not designing and heartless. She was pretty Jenny, who could think and feel. Chapter 5. The first two people to notice that Lancelot and Guinevere were falling in love with each other were Uncle Dapp and King Arthur himself. Arthur had been warned about this by Merlin, who was now safely locked up in his cave by the fickle Nimue, and he had been fearing it subconsciously, but he always hated knowing the future and had managed to dismiss it from his mind. Uncle Dapp's reaction was to give his pupil a lecture as they stood in the mews with the chastened Jer.
"God's feet!" said Uncle Dapp, with other exclamations of the same kind. "What is this? What are you doing? Is the finest knight in Europe to throw away everything I have taught him for the sake of a lady's beautiful eyes? And a married lady, too?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Don't know! Won't know! Holy Mother!" shouted Uncle Dapp. "Is it Guinevere I'm talking about, or is it not? Glory be to God forevermore!"
Lancelot took the old gentleman by the shoulders and sat him down on a chest.
"Look, Uncle," he said with determination, "I have been wanting to talk to you. Isn't it time you went back to Benwick?"
"Benwick?"
cried his uncle, as if he had been stabbed to the heart. "Yes, Benwick. You can't go on pretending to be my squire forever. For one thing, you are the brother of two kings, and for another thing, you are three times as old as I am.
It would be against the laws of arms.
Laws of arms! Shouted the old man. Poof!
Well, it is no good saying poof.
And me, that has taught you everything you know, me to go back to Benwick without having seen you prove yourself at all? Why, you have not even used your sword in front of me, not used, Joyeux. It is ingratitude, perfidy, treachery, sorrow to the grave, my faith, by the blue.
And the agitated old fellow went off into a long string of Gallic remarks, including the so-called William the Conqueror's oath of per splendorem Dei and the pasque Dieu, which was the imaginary King Louis the XI's idea of a joke. Inspired by the royal train of thought, he added the exclamations of Rufus, Henry I, John, and Henry III, which were in that order, by the holy face of Lucca, by God's death, by God's teeth, and by God's head. The gerfalcon, seeming to appreciate the display, roused his feathers heartily, like a housemaid shaking a mop out of the window.
"Well, if you won't go, you won't," said Lancelot. "But please, don't talk to me about the Queen.
I can't help it if we're fond of each other, and there's nothing wrong in being fond of people, is there? It's not as if the Queen and I were villains. When you begin lecturing me about her, you're making it seem as if there was something wrong between us. It's as if you thought ill of me, or did not believe in my honour. Please do not mention the subject again." Uncle Dap rolled his eyes, disarranged his hair, cracked his knuckles, kissed his fingertips, and made other gestures calculated to express his point of view. But he did not refer to the love affair afterwards. Arthur's reaction to the problem was complicated. Merlin's warning about his lady and his best friend had contained within itself the seeds of its own contradiction, for your friend can hardly be your friend if he is also going to be your betrayer. Arthur adored his rose-petaled Guinevere for her dash, and had an instinctive respect for Lancelot, which was soon to become affection. This made it difficult either to suspect them or not to suspect. The conclusion which he came to was that it would be best to solve the problem by taking Lancelot with him to the Roman War. That, at any rate, would separate the boy from Guinevere, and it would be pleasant to have his disciple with him, a fine soldier, whether Merlin's warning were true or not. The Roman War was a complicated business which had been brewing for years. It need not concern us long. It was in its way the logical consequence of Bedegraine, the continuation of that battle on a European scale. The feudal idea of war for ransom had been squashed in Britain, but not abroad, and now the foreign ransom hunters were after the newly settled king. A gentleman called Lucius, who was the dictator of Rome, and it is strange to reflect that dictator is the very word which Malory uses, had sent an embassy asking for tribute from Arthur. It was called a tribute before a battle and a ransom afterwards, to which the king, after consulting his parliament, had returned a message that no tribute was due. So the dictator Lucius had declared war. He had also sent his messengers, like Lars Porsena in Macaulay, to all the points of the compass to gather allies. He had no less than 16 kings marching with him from Rome into High Germany on their way to do battle with the English. He had allies from Ambige, Arag, Alessandri, Ind, Hermione, Euphrates, Afric, Europe the Large, Ertain, Elami, Arabi, Egypt, Damask, Damiet, Caia, Cappadoce, Tars, Turkey, Pounce, Pampoil, Suri, and Galicia, beside others from Greece, Cyprus, Macedon, Calabre, Cataland, Portingale, and many thousands of Spaniards. During the first weeks of Lancelot's infatuation for Guinevere, it became time for Arthur to cross the Channel to meet his enemy in France, and it was on this war that he decided to carry the young man with him. Lancelot, of course, was not at that time recognised as the chief knight of the Round Table, or he would have been taken in any case.
At the present period of his life, he had only fought one joust with Arthur himself, and the accepted captain of the knights was Gawain. Lancelot was angry at being taken from Guinevere, because he felt that it implied a lack of trust. Besides, he knew that Sir Tristram had been left with King Mark's wife of Cornwall on a similar occasion. He did not see why he should not be left with Guinevere in the same way. There is no need to go into the whole story of the Roman campaign, although it lasted several years. It was the usual sort of war, with a great deal of shoving and shouting on both sides, great strokes smitten, many men overthrown, and great valiances, prowesses, and feats of arms shown every day. It was Bedegraine enlarged, with the same refusal on Arthur's part to regard it as a sporting or commercial enterprise, although it did have its characteristic touches. Red-headed Gawain lost his temper when sent on an embassy and killed a man in the middle of the negotiations. Sir Lancelot led a terrific battle in which his men were outnumbered by 3-1. He slew the king Lyly and three great lords called Alacouc, Herord, and Herringdale. During the campaign, three notorious giants were accounted for, two of them by Arthur himself. Finally, in the last engagement, Arthur gave the Emperor Lucius such a blow on the head that Excalibur stinted not till it came to his breast, and it was discovered that the Soudan of Surrey and the King of Egypt and the King of Ethiopia, an ancestor of Haile Selassie, together with 17 other kings of diverse regions and 60 senators of Rome, were among the slain. Arthur put their bodies into sumptuous coffins, not sarcastically, and sent them to the Lord Mayor of Rome instead of the tribute which had been demanded. This induced the Lord Mayor and nearly the whole of Europe to accept him as overlord. The lands of Pleasance, Pavia, Petersaint, and the port of Tremble yielded him homage. The feudal convention of battle was broken for good, on the continent as well as in England. During this warfare, Arthur became genuinely fond of Lancelot, and by the time they came home, he no longer believed in Merlin's prophecy at all. He had put it at the back of his mind. Lancelot was acknowledged to be the greatest fighter in the army. Both of them were determined that Guinevere could not come between them, and the first few years were safely passed. Chapter 6. What sort of picture do people have of Sir Lancelot from this end of time? Perhaps they only think of him as an ugly young man who was good at games. But he was more than this. He was a knight with a medieval respect for honour. There is a phrase which you sometimes come across in country districts even nowadays, which sums up a good deal of what he might have tried to say. Farmers use it in Ireland as praise or compliment, saying, "So-and-so has a word. He will do what he promised." Lancelot tried to have a word. He considered it, as the ignorant country people still consider it, to be the most valuable of possessions. But the curious thing was that under the king post of keeping faith with himself and with others, he had a contradictory nature which was far from holy. His word was valuable to him not only because he was good, but also because he was bad. It is the bad people who need to have principles to restrain them. For one thing, he liked to hurt people. It was for the strange reason that he was cruel that the poor fellow never killed a man who asked for mercy or committed a cruel action which he could have prevented. One reason why he fell in love with Guinevere was because the first thing he had done was to hurt her. He might never have noticed her as a person if he had not seen the pain in her eyes. People have odd reasons for ending up as saints. A man who was not afflicted by ambitions of decency in his mind might simply have run away with his hero's wife, and then perhaps the tragedy of Arthur would never have happened. An ordinary fellow who did not spend half his life torturing himself by trying to discover what was right so as to conquer his inclination towards what was wrong, might have cut the knot which brought their ruin. When the two friends arrived in England from the Roman War,
the fleet landed at Sandwich. It was a grey September day, with the blue and copper butterflies flitting in the aftergrass, the partridges calling like crickets, the blackberries colouring, and the hazelnuts still nursing their tasteless little kernels in cradles of cotton wool. Queen Guinevere was on the beach to meet them. And the first thing Lancelot knew after she had kissed the king was that she was able to come between them after all. He made a movement as if his entrails were tying themselves in knots, saluted the queen, went off to bed in the nearest inn at once, and lay awake all night. In the morning, he asked leave of absence from the court.
"But you have hardly been at court at all," said Arthur. "Why do you want to go away so soon?"
"I ought to go away."
"Ought to go away?" asked the king. "What do you mean you ought to go away?"
Lancelot clenched his fist until the knuckles stood out and said, "I want to go on a quest. I want to find an adventure."
"But Lance..."
"It is what the Round Table is for, isn't it?" shouted the young man. "The knights are to go on quests, aren't they? To fight against might? What are you trying to stop me for? It's the whole point of the idea."
"Oh, come," said the king. "You needn't get excited about it. If you want to go, of course you can do whatever you like. I only thought it would be nice to have you with us for a little."
"Don't be cross, Lance. I don't know what has come over you."
"Come back soon," said the queen.
Chapter 7. This was the beginning of the famous quests. They were not made to win him fame or recreation. They were an attempt to escape from Guinevere. They were his struggles to save his honour, not to establish it. We shall have to describe one of the quests in detail, so as to show the way in which he tried to distract himself, and the way in which this famous honour of his worked. Also, it'll give a picture of the state of England which forced King Arthur to work for his theory of justice. It was not that Arthur was a prig. It was that his country of gramarye lay in such a toil of anarchy in the early days that some idea like the Round Table was needed to make the place survive. The warfare of people like Lot had been suppressed, but not the unbiddable baronage who lived like gangsters on their own estates. Barons were pulling teeth out of Jews to get their money, or roasting bishops who contradicted them. The villeins who belonged to bad masters were being basted over slow fires, or sprinkled with molten lead, or impaled, or left to die with their eyes gouged out, or else they were crawling along the roads on hands and knees because they'd been hamstrung. Petty feuds were raging to the destruction of the poor and helpless. And if a knight did happen to be dragged from his horse in a battle, he was so well screwed up that only an expert could do him harm. Philip Augustus of France, for instance, was dismounted and surrounded at the legendary Battle of Bouvines. Yet, as the unfortunate infantry were quite unable to puncture him, he was rescued soon after and continued to fight all the better because he'd lost his temper. But the story of Lancelot's first quest must speak for their troubled age of might in its own way. There were two knights on the borders of Wales, called Sir Carados and Sir Turquine. They were of Celtic stock. These two conservative barons had never yielded to Arthur, and they did not believe in any form of government except the rule of force. They had strong castles and wicked retainers who found more opportunity for wickedness under their leadership than they would have found in a settled state of society. They existed like eagles to prey on weaker brethren. It is unfair to compare them with eagles, for many of these birds are noble creatures, while Sir Turquine, at any rate, was not noble. If he had lived now, he might even have been locked in a lunatic hospital, and his friends would certainly have urged him to be psychoanalysed. One day, when Sir Lancelot had been riding on his adventure for about a month, and all the time going away from where he wanted to be, so that every pace of his horse was a torment, there appeared a knight in armour riding a great mare, with another bound knight thrown across the saddle bow. The bound knight had fainted. He was bloody and bedraggled, and his head, which hung by the mare's shoulders, had red hair. The riding knight who had captured him was a man of enormous stature, and Lancelot recognized him by his blazon as Sir Carados. "Who is your prisoner?" The big knight lifted the prisoner's shield, which was hanging behind him, and showed, "Or, a chevron gules between three thistles vert." "What are you doing with Sir Gawain?"
"Mind your own business," said Sir Carados.
Gawain must have come to his senses when the mare halted, for his voice now said, coming from upside down,
"Is that you, man, Sir Lancelot?"
"What cheer, Gawain? How stands it with you?"
"Never so hard," said Sir Gawain, "unless that ye help me, for without ye rescue me, I know nay knight that may."
He was speaking formally in the high language of chivalry, for in those days there were two kinds of speech, like high and low Dutch or Norman French and Saxon English. Lancelot looked at Sir Carados and said in the vernacular, "Will you put that fellow down and fight with me instead?"
"You are a fool," said Sir Carados. "I shall only serve you in the same way."
Then they put Gawain on the ground, tied up so that he could not get away, and prepared for battle. Sir Carados had a squire to give him his spear, but Lancelot had insisted on leaving Uncle Dap at home. He had to serve himself alone. The fight was different from the one with Arthur. For one thing, the knights were more evenly matched, and in the tilt with which it began, neither of them was unhorsed. They broke their ashwood spears to splinters, but both stayed in the saddle, and the horses stood the shock. In the sword play which followed, Lancelot proved to be the better of the two. After little more than an hour's fighting, he managed to give Sir Carados such a buffet on the helm that it pierced his brain pan, and then, while the dead man was still swaying in the saddle, he caught him by the collar, pulled him under his horse's feet, dismounted in the same instant, and struck off his head. He liberated Sir Gawain, who thanked him heartily, and rode on again into the wild ways of England, without giving Carados another thought. He fell in with a young cousin of his own, Sir Lionel, and they rode together in search of wrongs to redress. But it was unwise of them to have forgotten Sir Carados. One day, when they'd been riding for some time, they came to a forest during a sultry noon, and Lancelot was so worn out by the struggle inside him about the Queen, and by the weather as well, that he felt he could not go further. Lionel felt sleepy also, so they decided to lie down under an apple tree in a hedge, after tying their horses to sundry branches. Lancelot went to sleep at once, but the buzzing of the flies kept Sir Lionel awake. And while he was awake, a curious sight came by. The sight was of three knights fully armed, galloping for their lives, with a single knight in pursuit of them. The horse's hooves thundered on the ground and shook it, so that it was peculiar that Lancelot did not wake up, until, one by one, the huge pursuer ran his quarries down, unhorsed them, and bound them prisoners. Lionel was an ambitious boy. He thought that he would steal a march on his famous cousin. He got up quietly, put his armour to rights, and rode off to challenge the victor. In less than a minute, he too was lying on the ground, trussed so that he could not move, and before Lancelot woke, the whole pageant had disappeared. The mysterious conqueror in these four battles was Sir Turquine, a brother to the Carados whom Lancelot had lately killed. His habit was to take his captives into his grim castle, where he took off all their clothes and whacked them to his heart's content, as a hobby. Lancelot was still asleep when a new pageant came prancing by. In the middle of it there was a green silk canopy borne on four spears by four knights gorgeously apparelled. Under the canopy there rode four middle-aged queens on white mules, looking picturesque. They were passing the apple tree when Lancelot's charger gave a brassy neigh. Queen Morgan le Fay, who was the senior queen of the four, all witches, halted the procession and rode over to Sir Lancelot. He looked dangerous as he lay there in full armour of war among the long grasses.
"It is Sir Lancelot."
Nothing travels quicker than scandal, especially among supernatural people, so the four queens knew that he was in love with Guinevere. They also knew that he was now recognised as the strongest knight in the world. They were jealous of Guinevere on this account. They were delighted by the opportunity which they saw before them. They began to quarrel among themselves about which of them should have him for her magic.
"We need not quarrel," said Morgan le Fay. "I will put an enchantment on him so that he does not wake for 6 hours. When we have got him safely into my castle, he can choose which of us he will have himself."
This was done. The sleeping champion was carried on his shield between two knights into the castle chariot. The castle no longer had its fairy appearance as a castle of food, but its everyday aspect of an ordinary fortress. There he was put into a cold, bare chamber, fast asleep, and left until the enchantment wore off. When Lancelot woke, he didn't know where he was. The room was dark, and seemed to be made of stone like a dungeon. He lay in the dark, wondering what would happen next. Later, he began to think about Queen Guinevere. The thing which did happen was that a young damsel came in with his dinner and asked him what cheer.
"How are you, Sir Lancelot?"
"I don't know, fair damsel. I don't know how I got here, so I don't rightly know how I am."
"No need to be frightened," she said. "If you are as great a man as you are supposed to be, I may be able to help you tomorrow morning."
"Thank you. Whether you can help me or not, I should like you to think kindly of me." So the fair maid went away. In the morning there was banging of bolts and creaking of rusty locks, and several retainers in chainmail came into the dungeon. They lined up on either side of the door, and the magic queens came in behind them, all dressed in their best clothes. Each of the queens made a stately curtsy to Sir Lancelot. He stood up politely and bowed gravely to each of the queens. Morgan le Fay introduced them as the queens of Gore, Northgalis, Eastland, and the Out Isles.
"Now," said Morgan le Fay, "we know about you, so you need not think we don't. You are Sir Lancelot du Lac, and you are having a love affair with Queen Guinevere. You are supposed to be the best knight in the world, and that is why the woman is fond of you. Well, that is all over now. We four queens have you in our power, and you have to choose which of us you will have for your mistress. It would be no good unless you chose for yourself, obviously, but one of us you must have. Which is it to be?"
Lancelot said, "How can I possibly answer a thing like that?"
"You have to answer."
"In the first place," he said, "what you say about me and the king's wife of Britain is untrue. Guinevere is the truest lady unto her lord living. If I were free or had my armour, I would fight any champion you like to put forward to prove that. And in the second place, I certainly will not have any of you for my mistress. I am sorry if this is discourteous, but it is all I can say."
"Oh," said Morgan le Fay.
"Yes," said Lancelot.
"That is all?"
"Yes." The four queens curtsied with frigid dignity and marched out of the room. The sentries made smart about turns, their mail ringing on the stone floor. The light went out of the door. The door slammed, and the key creaked, and the bolts rumbled into their sockets. When the fair damsel came in with the next meal, she showed signs of wanting to talk to him. Lancelot noticed that she was a bold creature, who was probably fond of getting her own way. "You said you might be able to help me?" The girl looked suspiciously at him and said,
"I can help you, if you are who you are supposed to be, are you really Sir Lancelot?
I'm afraid I am.
I will help you, she said, if you will help me.
Then she burst into tears. While the damsel is weeping, which she did in a charming and determined way, we had better explain about the tournaments which used to take place in Grammary in the early days. A real tournament was distinct from a joust. In a joust, the knights tilted or fenced with each other singly for a prize, but a tournament was more like a free fight. A body of knights would pick sides, so that there were 20 or 30 on either side, and then they would rush together harum scarum. These mass battles were considered to be important. For instance, once you had paid your green fee for the tournament, you were admitted on the same ticket to fight in the jousts, but if you had only paid the jousting fee, you were not allowed to fight in the tourney. People were liable to be dangerously injured in the melees. They were not bad things altogether, provided they were properly controlled. Unfortunately, in the early days, they were seldom controlled at all. Merry England in Pendragon's time was a little like poor old Ireland in O'Connell's. There were factions. The knights of one county, or the inhabitants of one district, or the retainers of one nobleman, might get themselves into a state in which they felt a hatred for the faction which lived next door. This hatred would become a feud, and then the king, or leader of the one place, would challenge the leader of the other one to a tourney, and both factions would go to the meeting with full intent to do each other mischief. It was the same in the days of Papist and Protestant, or Stuart and Orangeman, who would meet together with shillelaghs in their hand and murder in their hearts. "Why are you crying?" asked Sir Lancelot.
"Oh, dear," sobbed the damsel. "That horrid king of Northgalis has challenged my father to a tournament next Tuesday, and he has got 3 knights of King Arthur's on his side, and my poor father is bound to lose. I am afraid he will get hurt."
"I see. And what is your father's name?"
"He is King Bagdemagus."
Sir Lancelot got up and kissed her politely on the forehead. He saw at once what he was expected to do. "Very well," he said. "If you can rescue me out of this prison, I will fight in the faction of King Bagdemagus next Tuesday."
"Oh, thank you," said the maiden, wringing out her handkerchief. "Now I must go, I'm afraid, or they will miss me downstairs."
Naturally, she was not going to help the magic queen of Northgalis to keep Lancelot in prison when it was the king of Northgalis himself who was going to fight her father. In the morning, before the people of the castle had got up, Lancelot heard the heavy door opening quietly. A soft hand was put in his, and he was led out in the darkness. They went through 12 magic doors until they reached the armory, and there was all his armor, bright and ready. When he had put it on, they went to the stables, and there was his charger scratching on the cobbles with a sparkling shoe.
"Remember?"
"Of course," he said, and he rode out over the drawbridge into the morning light. While they had crept through the corridors of Castle Chariot, they had made a plan about meeting King Bagdemagus. Lancelot was to ride to an abbey of White Friars, which was situated nearby, and there he was to meet the damsel, who would, of course, be forced to flee from Queen Morgan because of her treachery in letting him escape. At this abbey, they were to wait until King Bagdemagus could be brought over, and then the arrangements for the tournament were to be made. Unfortunately, the castle chariot was in the Forest Sauvage, and Lancelot now lost his way to the abbey. He and his horse wandered about all day, bumping against branches, getting tangled in blackberry bushes, and rapidly losing their tempers. In the evening, they stumbled on a pavilion of red sendal, with nobody inside. He got off his horse and looked at the pavilion. There was something queer about it, luxurious as it was in the rocky wood, and without anybody in sight. "This is a strange pavilion," he thought sadly, for his mind was full of Guinevere. But I suppose I may as well stay in it for the night. Either it is here for some adventure or other, in which case I ought to try the adventure, or else the owners have gone away on holiday, and in that case they will not mind my taking shelter for one evening. Anyway, I am lost, and there is nothing else I can do. He unharnessed the horse and spancelled him. Then he took off his own armour and hung it neatly on a nearby tree with the shield on top. After this, he ate some bread which the girl had given him, drinking water from a stream which ran beside the pavilion, stretched his arms out until the elbows went click, yawned, hit his front teeth with his fist 3 times, and went to bed. The bed was a sumptuous one, with a coverlet of red sendal to match the tent. Lancelot rolled himself in it, pressed his nose into the silk pillow, kissed it for Guinevere, and was fast asleep. It was moonlight when he woke, and a naked man was sitting on his left foot, trimming his fingernails. Lancelot, who had been woken from his love sleep with a start, moved suddenly in the bed when he felt the man. The man, equally surprised at feeling a movement, jumped up and snatched his sword. Lancelot jumped out on the other side of the bed and ran for his own arms, where they were hanging in the tree. The man came after him, waving his blade and trying to get a cut at him from behind. Lancelot reached the tree in safety and swung round with his weapon in his hand. They looked strange and terrible in the moonlight, both stark naked, with their silver steel glancing under the harvest moon. "Now!" cried the man, and he aimed a furious swipe at Lancelot's legs. The next minute he had dropped his sword and was holding his stomach with both hands, doubled up and whistling. The cut which Lancelot had given welled over with blood which looked black in the moonlight, and you could see some of the insides of the stomach with their secret life laid open. "Don't hit me!" cried the man. "Mercy! Don't hit me again! You have killed me!" "I am sorry," said Lancelot. "You did not even wait till I had a sword." The man went on wailing, "Mercy! Mercy!" Lancelot stuck his blade in the ground and went over to examine the wound. "I'm not going to hurt you," he said. "It's all right. Let me see." "You have cut open my liver," said the man accusingly. "Well, I can't do more than say I am sorry, even if I have. I don't know what we were fighting about anyway. Lean on my shoulder and we'll get you into bed." When he had got the man to bed and stopped his bleeding and discovered that the wound was not a mortal one, a beautiful lady appeared in the opening of the tent. They had lit a rushlight so that she saw what had happened in a flash, and immediately she began screaming at the top of her voice.